From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Terry Gilliam has been in the business of bringing the fantastical to life for a long time in film, illustration, animation, all kinds of story. He was the American-born member of the Monty Python comedy team, spending most of his time off-screen, but with his work very much on-screen, the distinctive Monty Python short animations of giant feet crushing things and heads gobbling things up. When the group went into film, Terry Gilliam co-directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and then many more distinctive films with the creative verve that critics call Gilliam-esque. Now he's telling his own story. This hour on Point, we talk with the creative Terry Gilliam. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your question for Terry Gilliam on Monty Python, his many films, the creative life? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. First try at directing a movie, co-directed with Terry Jones, 1975's Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Here's the scene from that movie where King Arthur, played by Graham Chapman, comes across the Black Knight, played by John Cleese. Black Knight won't let Arthur pass. Arthur must fight the knight, refuses to surrender.
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've heard worse.
You liar!
Come on, you pansy!
There, with blood gushing throughout, Terry Gilliam joins me now from New York. He's directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Jabberwocky, Time Bandits, the Oscar-nominated Brazil, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, The Fisher King, 12 Monkeys, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and most recently, The Zero Theorem, and many more. He's out with a big, zesty visual memoir titled Gilliam-esque, a pre-posthumous memoir. You can find an excerpt which includes some of his fantastic illustrations at our website, onpointradio.org. Boy, there's a long introduction. Terry Gilliam, welcome to On Point.
Hello. I'm just dozing off.
Yeah,
that was
no
such
doubt.
A long intro.
Yeah, sorry. We got carried away. It's something about you, sir. What an amazing bunch of work. And I really didn't know the backstory, I have to say. And it's amazing when I do read it. Minnesota kid who grows up first Medicine Lake and then out to California. And by the late 1960s, you're showing up in the U.K., what, in your early 20s still, and getting hooked up with Monty Python? How did that happen?
Oh, how long is the program?
16 hours.
Well, I suppose the connection that got me into Python was it started here in New York, and I was co-editing a magazine called Help with Harvey Kurtzman, who gave the world Mad Comics.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, kind of a god for the our generation of comics.
Yes.
And cartoonists. And anyway, what we did in the magazine were fumetti, which were basically like a comic strip except with live-action people in there, living actors and location sets, everything. People spoke with balloons like they do in comic
mm-hmm.
books. That's the fumetti part of it. Anyway, I was always looking for actors who would work for $15 a day, and there was the Cambridge Footlights Review was playing in New York, and there was a tall guy in the group called John Cleese, and I got him to be in one of our stories, and it was actually rather prescient because it's a story about a man who seems to falls in love with and has, I think, carnal relations with his daughter's Barbie doll. Anyway, and John went on to go through 4 marriages at the moment in this quest that we set him on very early on in his life. The Barbie doll quest. And so John and I became friends. Then some years later, when I decided to leave America and ended up in England, and I was still working in magazine work, and John by then had become very well known on television with David Frost. And I said, introduce me to somebody in TV. And he introduced me to a producer who liked my cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was producing a show called Do Not Adjust Your Set with some young comics called Eric Idle, Michael Palin, and Terry Jones.
Yeah.
And I started working with them, and that led to Python.
Did it matter to them that you were an American? Was that strange to them, or they liked your work, so come on in, Terry? What was that like?
Well, it began with Eric. Eric has always been a hunter of the exotic and the glamorous. And I, at that point in my life, very, very brief moment, was exotic and glamorous to him.
As the young American in London.
Exactly, with long hair and a very fancy sheepskin coat that I had painted myself.
Living large.
Oh, I was something special. What was very funny, Eric was great. He was very welcoming, blah, blah, blah. Unlike the other two proto-pythons, Mike and Terry, who sat in the back looking out from their rat hole and looking at this guy who was trying to invade their territory.
Yeah.
But in the end, the invasion was successful and we all started working together.
Why did you leave America? I'm looking at your bio and reading here. I mean, you were sort of the all-American boy, valedictorian, and, into the sports and the cheerleading and everything. You were sort of doing the whole thing. And then, it's the 60s.
Went sour.
Well, describe the souring.
Well, there was a little thing called the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And there also, it was... America was a very exciting time because things were changing. I mean, civil rights movement, gay rights, feminism. It was great. And I was on that side. And if you're on that side, you were probably against the other side, which was the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And I was finding it all very disillusioning for a kid who had grown up believing in truth, justice, and the American way, and our goodness and greatness in the world. And I became very disillusioned politically with America. And I had hitchhiked around Europe for about 5 months, fell in love with Europe. I love this... this world that was still connected to an ancient past, and it wasn't ignoring that past. It was future, present, and past, unlike America, which at that point just seemed to be present. And so I left the country. I was getting very angry, and I'd been involved in a demonstration in L.A. and got beaten up by the cops, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm getting very angry, and when I'm angry, I tend towards dreams of violence. And I thought it's better to leave the country and become a rather pacific cartoonist in England than a bomb thrower in America.
There's a fantastical quality, of course, huge, that people love about your work, but there's also throughout in your movies this sense of opposition to authority, to the overbearing power. Do you see that? Have you felt that consciously as a theme in your work throughout?
Yeah, I don't trust it. I don't trust power at a certain level. I mean, I like democracy at a ground level, but as things go up, all systems become corrupt and they become about themselves, protecting themselves at the expense of what they were initially designed for. And so it's a basic mistrust of authority, bureaucracy, all those things that go into running a very large and complex system.
That look of the Monty Python animation and illustrations and cutouts that's what you brought. I mean, it puts me in mind of the old Beatles cover on Sgt. Pepper, but also sort of steampunk these days. It had that retro throwback Victorian era, but then with a big zany twist to it and your own illustrations in there as well. Where did that come from? Was that just in the air at that time, or was that your stamp on the late 1960s?
No, I don't think it was necessarily in the air. I've always just been attracted to old things as much as future things. It really took off in Brazil, where I was doing a film that was ostensibly about the future. But they're always about the present, comments on the present. But because it was about the future, the fact is all future films seem to be describing and showing a world that had nothing to do with the world we were really living in. And the fact is any technology that we're involved with is both futuristic and very much rooted in the past. And that always intrigued me. So to me, a complete world, it involves the dreams of the future, but also the mud of the past. That's what I did. And And people were commenting about that in Brazil, the ducts. Mm-hmm. The ducts were visible as opposed to, you know, wires behind nice modern walls. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kept revealing, I suppose, the guts of the system. And then one day I was trolling the internet and discovered steampunk, and my stuff was all over it. Yeah. And there are those that think I was, you know, one of the originators of steampunk, but it wasn't really. I mean, it just, I guess what I did fell into that category. But
were you ripped off, or is it all pulling on the past? I mean, you did plenty of, forget the copyright, copying yourself back in the day, I read in your Gillian-esque book. Memoir.
Well, I mean, now, I mean, anything you use now, if you make a film and the Chrysler Building is, you know, prominent in the shot, you have to pay the Chrysler Building to be in there. There's no public space anymore. People are allowed to advertise everywhere and invade my personal space as I walk down the street. But if I show those ads in my movie, I have to pay them. I find this quite extraordinary.
Terry Gilliam, he's out with a new memoir, a very rambunctious memoir, as you can imagine, that strongly visual over a big, big lifetime of work that has delighted and challenged on many fronts. Title is Gilliam-esque, a pre-posthumous memoir. We'll touch on why pre-posthumous. I guess it's the only way to do a memoir, but it's a funny story on that front. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. Monty Python fans, how did you see Terry Gilliam in that crew? What did his wild animation cutouts and old photos and Harry's stomping feet bring to Monty Python, the show, the humor? Can you imagine being the one American import there in 1969? Arthur's song from Monty Python and the Holy Grail behind us here. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
He was unaware of atoms and all things nuclear, ignorant of fish and chips with salt and vinegar.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Terry Gilliam, the one and only American-born member of the Monty Python comedy team, animator, occasional actor, screenwriter, director of Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Brazil and 12 Monkeys and the Fisher King and a whole lot more. He's out with a new memoir. It is Gilliam-esque. It is big. He jokes it was headed for classy coffee tables and then in Gilliam-esque fashion, it just kind of got away from him. It's quite a wonder to see a pre-posthumous memoir, he calls it. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. What's your question on how it's all worked? Monty Python and well beyond. You always know when you're seeing a Terry Gilliam film, do you see the connections from Holy Grail to Brazil to Baron Munchausen to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas with Johnny Depp and all the rest? Here's just a little bit from the 1985 movie Brazil. Terry Gilliam directed, nominated for an Oscar for Best Writing. Mr. Buttle is arrested as a terrorist on Christmas Eve. An official from the Ministry of Information reads him his arrest warrant.
Mr. Buttle, Archibald, residing at 412 North Tower, Shangri-La Towers, has been invited to assist the Ministry of Information with certain inquiries, and that he is liable to certain financial obligations as specified in Council Order RB/CZ/907/X. Sign here, please.
Where are you taking him?
There. Thank you. Same again, please. Just there. Press harder this time. Good.
Oh, what is this all about?
That is your receipt for your husband. Thank you.
The receipt for your husband from the super officious official in Brazil, directed by Terry Gilliam. Terry Gilliam joins us from New York. And Mr. Gilliam, we have a line of callers for you that stretches around the block. I want to begin to bring them in. Harry in Burlington, Vermont, you're on with Terry Gilliam.
Wow, thanks for taking my call. This is amazing to be on the phone. I'm such a huge fan. I grew up watching the show Monty Python. In particular, I'm a cartoonist today, but that the animation at the beginning of that show I thought was so surreal and so strange. But anyway, the show and your work and your films have had such a big impact on me. But I wanted to ask you a specific question. I have a 22-year-old he's a film major in Manhattan, and he's bright and he's doing well. But if he were your son, entering into this business, what advice would you give him? My advice to him has always been just keep reading and writing. But I'm curious to know what your advice would be for a young filmmaker.
No, I agree. I think read, write, study history, politics, you know, educate yourself so you have something to talk about when you make movies. What I don't encourage people to do is to go to film school and watch other movies constantly, because then you're only going to end up directing movies that are relating to other movies. And also, I think it's very important to get a, you know, training in other jobs like a plumber or electrician. So when the film business ejects you or doesn't accept you, you've got a way of making a living. I mean, I didn't go to film school because, well, because, just because there's a million reasons, but because I think you can learn pretty much everything you need to know about filmmaking by watching films. But the point is, I think I want people to be educated so they can comment about life, about society, about anything rather than just relating to other movies that already have been made.
Terry Gilliam, you know, of course you have this enfant terrible reputation. You've made all these films, but you've battled with the system plenty. I mean, do you suggest your career path to someone young and coming in? Is this where satisfaction lies? Or when you look back, you say, oh, I could have done it. I could have lounged on the decks of yachts and done it so much more easily if I'd gone with the flow. Or are you happy with your sort of rebel way?
Well, I don't think I have a choice. You just are who you are. Mm-hmm. And my approach is that when I'm making something, I want control of it, and I want to, you know, it's mine. I'm signing it. I put my name on it, and so I'm responsible for it. And what I don't want is to be responsible for the mistakes of executives and people who are frightened about losing their jobs because they greenlit one of my movies. I never had a career. I never wanted a career. I make each movie I make is the first and last movie I'll ever make, is the way I approach it. To try to match what I did is very difficult because I wanted to be a filmmaker, but I didn't know and had no desire to work my way up through a system from T-Boy and on up. And I was lucky to have ended up in England with Python becoming a success, people coming forward, offering us money to make a movie, and then being in the position with Terry Jones to say, anybody named Terry gets to direct. Yeah, right. And the others in the group agreed. and you know,
not always easily reading your
work. Not everybody's going to be able to do this. and then your name is up there directed by, and the world knows you as a film director.
Yes.
And that's
boom.
It. So it's not a career or a journey that most people would get to do. But the point is to make things that you are passionate about, things you really want to say, it seems to me. That's always been my approach.
Harry, you're a cartoonist. If I recall, with The New Yorker even maybe, what was it about Terry Gilliam in the late 60s, early 70s, the Monty Python era that caught your eye as someone who has become a rather prominent cartoonist yourself, Harry?
Well, specifically, it was the animation. I mean, you have to remember this was the 70s, so there were really two things that we watched for humor, and it was SNL and Monty Python. I mean, those were hugely influential things. Mm-hmm. But you know, the animation at the beginning of Python and throughout the show was so strange and so creative and unlike anything I'd seen before. And when I look back and I see like Robert Grossman is still a great cartoonist, and I think of, you know, the 60s and the early 70s and the type of animation that was being done, it was kind of groundbreaking for me. And it you know, wasn't peanuts, it wasn't your typical Rankin Bass stuff, it was just terrific stuff. So it forced me and helped me and my buddies to think outside the box.
It's funny that you mentioned Robert Grossman of all the people out there, because he was a real hero of mine. He did these beautiful cartoons, illustrations, and they were with airbrush. Mm-hmm. Is what nobody else was doing airbrushing in those days, except for retouching former Soviet leaders out of historical photographs. Yeah. And Grossman was wonderful, and I really admired his stuff and tried to copy it and taught myself how to airbrush just by looking at his stuff. And that was interesting. So with Python, I would either be doing my drawings or airbrushing characters into existence. But the lack of time was always the problem. So I then had to resort to cutting out Albrecht Dürer engravings and using old photographs. These were the ways I could get enough material done for each show. And so it became this mixture of basically pragmatic choices. How else can you do it in that time with that kind of money except by using other people's art?
But there was a freedom in it that was just wonderful then and now. Harry, I'm so glad you called. If I may get one more for you, Terry, Ray in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Ray, you're on the air with Terry Gilliam, Monty Python and much more.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having Terry on. Terry, I can't thank you enough for what you did for all of us and all the productions and everything else.
Thanks.
My main question is, do you feel that because you went to Europe and hiked around and all that, and I did that too, that broadened things enough for you to be able to get involved with this type of humor, with surrealism, realism, politics, the whole gamut, and be able to present all this creativity in that in the typical British dry humor form? And also, when the movie Brazil came out, it was like, what could be ever be next? And when you people did Brazil, I'm telling you, that was the topper. So anyways, it's great to talk with you, and we'll take the comment off there. Thanks a lot for
being
able to talk.
Thank you, Ray. Great. Terry, did you have to go across the pond to do what you did, what you do?
Well, I think I did because, okay, when I was here in New York working in Los Angeles, there were outlets for cartoons, and I was cartooning, and most of them were political in one form or another. And Help magazine was the base of where I was operating from. But at the same time, sitting here in New York listening to The Goon Show, suddenly it was on radio here. Mm-hmm. People started playing it. Mm-hmm. Ealing comedies, I loved. So I was a real Anglophile before I went east, as it were.
And
then when I hitchhiked around Europe for like 5 months, it just opened my eyes because even though I was very critical of what was going on in America, I was shocked by the way the rest of the world perceived us. And then I realized, okay, my view of the world is very limited living here. Mm. And by living in England or France or wherever, it gave me a better perspective on what was really going on. And suddenly being with other cultures and being able to wander through the national museums in England, I'm getting more and more wrapped up in the past and other times and other ways of seeing the world. And, I think it's all been part of the mix. Without that, without leaving the country, I would have been doing very different things, I think.
You became a British subject, I guess, is the word, in the late 60s?
Actually it was the early 70s.
Early 70s, okay. And then you lived quite comfortably with dual citizenship for a long, long time. In 2006 or so, you actually renounced your American citizenship. What suddenly made it so unpalatable? Why did you take that step at that point?
Well, I mean, I'd been living in England. I'd been happily paying taxes in two countries. As an American in another country, you still have to pay taxes in America even though you don't live here.
Yep.
So that's just a reality. So all that was going on fine. It was getting a little bit irritating because I wasn't getting any of the benefits of my tax paying in America. You know, I wasn't driving on the roads. Mm-hmm. I wasn't flying any of the bombers that we were making. Mm-hmm. I didn't get the jet aircraft. Anyway, so that was going on. And then the second inauguration, the election of George W. Bush was a thing that pushed me over the edge. I was so angered by the stupidity of so many people voting for the man that would make their lives worse, quite frankly. Mm. And I thought, okay, I've got to leave. And so I renounced my citizenship, which means when you do that, you are then on parole for 10 years. I have 1 year left of my parole.
What does that mean, Terry, on parole? Do you have to check in with somebody?
No, I can. I'm only allowed in this lovely country 30 days in any 1 year.
Oh, renounce and your access becomes limited.
Yeah. No, they don't like losing taxpayers, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it's an act of treason. And it's the irony, of course, is that 2 weeks after I renounced, Hollywood called me and offered me a really good Western that would had to be shot in New Mexico.
Maybe a spaghetti Western will have to do.
So I didn't get to do it, but there you go.
Terry Gilliam is with us of Monty Python and much, much more. Tara is calling from Bluffton, South Carolina. Tara, you're on with Terry.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say, Mr. Gilliam, wow, magical, whimsical, beyond belief. When I was living in New York City many years ago, you were filming The Fisher King in my neighborhood, and
right.
I got to watch you in action.
I apologize.
No, you were amazing. You commanded your actors in such a way that it was like watching poetry in motion.
Describe that, Tara. What do you mean he commanded his actors in the streets of New York? The Fisher King, 1991, it came out.
He basically, I think you had like walked through the scene before, and it was under this amazing ornate building with Amanda and another
This is
actor,
Metropolitan Life on Lower Park Avenue.
Metropolitan Life. Yes, yes. And a beautiful, ornate, amazing building. And you had a little, like, powwow with them before. And you got very animated with it. And I remember I had my nephew who was just an infant. And there was a homeless man who was playing with my nephew. Years later, I was working at as a waitress in San Francisco. And I found out that it was Robin Williams.
Let's hear a little bit of that. Stick with us, Tara. You are observed, Terry Gilliam, even when you don't know it. People are watching, and all these years later, Tara remembers you. This is just one of the scenes from The Fisher King. Robin Williams plays the homeless guy, nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor in a leading role for this film. Here's the scene where Lydia, his love interest, listens as Robin Williams' character, Perry, declares his love for her in The Fisher King.
I know what you order, and I know on Wednesdays you go to that Tim Tam parlor, and I know that you get a jawbreaker before you go back into work. And I know you hate your job and you don't have many friends, and I know sometimes you feel a little uncoordinated and you don't feel as wonderful as everybody else, and feeling as alone and separate as you feel you are, and I love you. I love you. And I think you're the greatest thing since Spice Rex.
Since Spice Rex, Robin Williams, now gone. Sorry for that. Robin Williams commanding. I mean, isn't that what Robin Williams does there? Were you commanding Robin Williams and the other actors around the streets?
No, I don't command. I beg. I finagle. I plead. I do those things. Now, the thing with actors I've discovered is to be a wonderful audience to them, because they, you know, they're performing and they want to know that what they're doing is achieving the effect they're after. So if they're funny, I'm laughing right there. If they're doing something like Robin doing that scene, I'm probably weeping. And that's just the way it works. I think it's very important. I mean, I love actors, and choose the right people and sort of convince. We eat a lot and we talk about things, and hopefully we're all agreed to make the same movie. I mean, Robin in that movie is just, it is the closest to the complete Robin Williams you'll ever see. The extremes of who Robin was and just the sweetness. A few months ago, they've done a Criterion Collection, have released a new Blu-ray of it, and I had to watch it for technical reasons. This was shortly after Robin died, and I was not looking forward to it. And I came out of it at the end just grinning like a fool, because there was Robin in all his glory, and he will live forever in that film as who he really was, I think.
Robin Williams in Terry Gilliam's The Fisher King. Behind Us Hill, Brazil, sung by Jeff Muldor from Terry Gilliam's 1985 of Brazil. Terry is out with a new pre-posthumous memoir. He calls it Gilliam-esque. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Now, when twilight dims the sky above, recalling of our love, there's one thing that I'm certain of, return. I will to old Brazil.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Terry Gilliam, one and only American-born member of the Monty Python comedy team, animator, occasional actor, screenwriter, director of Monty Python and the Holy Grail in Brazil, and 12 Monkeys, and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and The Fisher King, and a whole lot more. You can join us. What's your question on the creative life for Terry Gilliam, on his creative life? He shares a lot of it in his new memoir, Gilliam-esque, a pre-posthumous memoir. Just out, you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's just a bit from his 2009 film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Here, Tony, played by Heath Ledger, who died midway through the production of that film, speaks to a crowd of women who are interested in what the Imaginarium is. Ledger's character, Tony, sells them on the idea of the power of the imagination.
Listen, can I ask you a question? Do you dream? Or should I say, can you put a price on your dreams? Or the dreams of the less fortunate in this world? Is there a price for them? Or are you all in despair at your inability to change what is wrong in this world?
There from Terry Gilliam's work. Terry Gilliam, how did you come to know that Heath Ledger had died in the middle of this film? Where were you? Where was he? What was going on?
I know exactly where I was. I was in Vancouver. We had just, we had finished on a Saturday night, just after midnight. Next morning, I and the crew that was going to Canada left. Heath went to New York. Mm-hmm. And now, I think it was Tuesday, I was in the art department in Vancouver trying to save a few bucks on a set, you know, if we could make it a little bit smaller, a little bit that. And my daughter, Amy, came in and says, could you come into the office? And I said, I'm trying to save another $15 here. And she said, get in here right now. And there it was. And it was the BBC website on the web. And it said Heath Ledger dies.
Yeah.
And this was impossible because he was, you know, alive and well, and there's no reason that – I thought it was a hoax. I just didn't know what this was about. And when it proved to be true, it was – I mean, I remember myself, Nicola Pecorini, who was my cinematographer, we literally just laid down on the floor and said, that's it. It's – we're over. The film is over. Everything's over. It was so unbelievable, so horrible because Heath was family. Heath was he was kind of like my son, and gone. It was extraordinary. I think the other thing that happened that as we were lying there, a huge flock of ravens came sweeping past the window, blocking out the sun for a moment. I thought, oh, my God, this is getting, cosmic.
Yeah.
What's going on?
You brought in that tragic situation, then you brought in, Johnny Depp and Colin Farrell and Jude Law to sort of apportion that role and rely on the audience to kind of roll with there would be different faces of this character. That's all part of the imagination.
But this is the thing. What happens when you surround yourself with people that are stronger or more resilient than I am. Mm-hmm. And my daughter was one, and she says, you're going to finish this film. I said, I'm not going to finish this film. It's over. And they kept hammering me. And she finally said, call Johnny. Call Johnny Depp. And I did, and I'd introduced Heath to Johnny, and they'd become very good friends. And Johnny said, I'm there. Whatever you want, I'm there. And at this point, the financiers, the bank, everybody else was going home because you can't finish a film in the middle of the film when the lead actor is no longer there. And that call stopped the retreat. Everybody hesitated. Johnny Depp. Ooh. And then I managed to get because I said I don't want one person to replace Heath. That's impossible. So three actors. And then I said, and they've all got to be friends of Heath. And Jude Law and Colin Farrell came to the rescue as well. And it, I really didn't rewrite anything. I just changed a couple small elements. And we finished the film. And people, when they see it, find it very hard to believe it wasn't written that way.
You have a long habit of working with the same actors again and again. Johnny Depp, prominent among them. What is it about working with the same actors that particularly appeals to you?
Well, it's the fact that certain actors you work with, you realize we're on the same wavelength. We really, really enjoy being together, not just working together, just and you fire ideas back and forth. Someone like Johnny, when we did Fear and Loathing, he was a huge Python fan. He actually said he wished, had he been a bit older, he would have been part of the group. And at that point, people didn't realize just how amazingly, brilliantly funny Johnny could be. Mm-hmm. And he was. And so every moment was creative, you know, ping pong going on with him. It was wonderful. Same, Jeff Bridges is another one who, you know, isn't known necessarily for his comic ability, but Jeff is brilliantly funny. And Jeff is just one of the great actors on the planet because he has gravitas at the same time as he has a certain level of silliness. So it's when you're lucky enough to bump into an actor, actors like that, you want to do more things with them. That's as simple as that.
Mal in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Mal, you're on the air with Terry Gilliam.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Terry.
How do you do?
I was a huge fan of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I thought you did a great job of bringing that book to life on screen. I was wondering if you could share a story about Hunter Thompson. I understand that he consulted on the film.
Makes a cameo.
He's in the film.
Yeah.
That was one of the most painful days during the shoot, the day Hunter was on the set.
Oh, tell us, tell us. We're all ears now.
Because Hunter is extraordinary, and he has to be the center of attention. Is always one of the things with Hunter. He's used to that position. And so during the day, he was just causing trouble wherever possible. And the day went on into overtime, which is terrifying. We had to shoot the
money
scene
wise,
that takes place money-wise, exactly, because money's always the Damocles sword hanging over my head.
Yeah.
And so we were doing the scene in the Matrix, and there was supposedly the Jefferson airplane on the stage back there. We had 60 or 70 or 80 extras, all being paid overtime at this point. And it's a scene where Johnny walks through the Matrix and he passes a table, and there on the table sitting there is Hunter. And there's a brief little interaction there. Now, we're ready to shoot this thing, and Hunter, who's been getting ready for this all day, suddenly says, "I'm not going out there. The table's in the wrong position. I'm a journalist, and I wouldn't be sitting in the middle of the action. I'd be over the edge." He was going on, and it's like, he's not going to go out there. He's just being a complete pain in the ass, frankly.
Yeah.
And it ended up with Johnny, Leila Nabulsi, who was the producer, and myself surrounding him like a pack of sheepdogs around a recalcitrant sheep
trying to get it
into the corral. And Leila was brilliant. She got the best-looking female extra, plonked her down on the table, and that was the bait. And Hunter took the bait and sat down there. And then, of course, when it came to shooting, he wouldn't pay attention to anything. Johnny, we set up this very elaborate shot. Johnny walks past waiting for the moment of catching Hunter's eye, and Hunter's too busy talking to the girl. It went on like that all evening.
Mal, there's a Hunter S. Thompson story for you from Fear and Loathing. Ed Attila writes to us on Twitter, wants to know, he says, in all his movies, yours, Terry, I always saw particular Gilliam-esque lighting. Is he on to something there?
I actually don't know what she's talking about. I don't know.
There's an answer.
Yes, because I've worked with different cinematographers, and they light differently. I do like beautiful lighting, and that's what we do. And I don't want it to look like normal Hollywood lighting, which is, you know, everything is overlit. So there's, you know, I like chiaroscuro.
Mm-hmm.
And shadows are very important because our imagination grows in shadow space. And
amen.
So I like to leave areas that are quite dark. And so it's a chance for you to fill in the gaps.
And Tia, there's an answer for you. Chiaroscuro. J.K. Rowling wanted you to direct Harry Potter. The studio didn't. Are you, how do you feel about how all that turned out?
Well, it's just, it's not a surprise, is it? It's obvious.
Well, explain why.
Well, J.K. Rowling and the producer, yes. And other, I remember even Alan Parker was offered the job, and he says, why are you talking to me? You should be talking to Gilliam. And so the studios, to show that they really were listening to J.K. and her producer, flew me out to L.A. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was not going to get the job, but it was a first-class ticket, and it allowed me to do some other stuff while I was out in L.A.
Just explain it. So you wouldn't get it because Terry Gilliam would not be given that big piece of work because?
Terry Gilliam was trouble in their mind because I was the guy that rubbed the nose of Universal Pictures into the ordure over Brazil. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it went way over budget. There were all kinds of fights and problems there, and your reputation was made.
Well, no, I mean, Brazil actually came in under budget. It was Munchausen that went over.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, yes.
Yeah, but it was Brazil, which I embarrassed the studios and forced them to actually release the film against their wishes and publicly thumb my nose at the head of Universal. And these are things that are not, encouraged in Hollywood if you want a career. But there's payback time. So anyway, I got the flight out there and I had the meeting with the studio executives and the head of the studio. And what was interesting, in advance of that meeting, a couple of the executives had called my agent and said, okay, whatever happens, they're on my side. These were the executives I knew had daggers in their hands waiting to stab me in the back. Mm. But that's beside the point. But what happened in the course of the meeting, I get enthusiastic about the project. Mm-hmm. I start throwing in ideas, describing what we could do because I've got an audience. Mm-hmm. And the fact is I won over, I think, the majority of them. But
it's kind of amazing in itself. It's
great. But the head of the studio was falling asleep at the same time, so I knew I was doomed.
Didn't matter. Terry Gilliam with us, not the director of the Harry Potter movies. Well, that's another story. Drew in Boston, you're on the air, Drew. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And greetings, Mr. Gilliam.
Greetings to you.
So I am a huge admirer of your work. I've been following you since I was younger. I just wanted to say thank you for everything you've done. You brought a lot of joy to the world. I guess I have one question, and perhaps I could have found this out maybe on the internet somewhere, but I wanted to ask you, after seeing Lost in La Mancha, do you have any interest or plans or ideas for trying to revisit that wonderful attempt at that project again? And I'm very curious to know if that's something you're interested in.
Terry Gilliam's approach to Don Quixote. Where does it stand, Terry?
Well, right now I should be shooting the film rather than sitting here in New York talking to you. Mm-hmm. However, I spent the last couple of years getting it all up and running again. And this time around, it was John Hurt playing Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. And back in May of this year, we were getting ready to start preparations and getting the crew and everything together and start the work for, the beginning of June is when we were supposed to start and we were supposed to be shooting now. Mm. And in the middle of May, John announced to the world that he had pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
So the whole thing has once again stumbled. And I'm not sure where I'm right now. We've got the money, we've got part of the cast, and I need a Quixote, and we're on the search at the moment. So I've since Lost in La Mancha, I think I've had two, if not three, goes at getting it going, but at each point something occurs to block it. So I'm beginning to believe in the curse of Quixote.
You and Quixote seem like a perfect match. We hope that it gets made. Mike in New York. Mike, our time is very short, but you're on. Make it quick, sir.
I would try. Hi, Tom. Thanks, Mr. Gilliam, for all your work. I'm a big fan. And I consider Mr. Gilliam a master of satire in the best kind of sense, like Don Quixote, which you were just talking about. My impression is, and please tell me if I'm way off on this, that satire is very hard to pull off nowadays, or at least harder than it used to be 40, 50 years ago, because the self-awareness is kind of baked into our movies, our comedy, even our politicians.
We're all satirizing ourselves all the time, maybe. Hmm?
Yeah, exactly. It's all with a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and it's very hard to have that approach where you're finding the truth and you're presenting it in a clever, subversive way.
Mike, let us grab it right there because our time's so short. Terry, what do you say to that observation? Tougher?
No, I think it's very interesting. I mean, that we are, we're being so clever. We're pretending to be knowing. We're pretending to be, I don't know anything is the reality, especially since, I'm in the media. So all the things I read about myself really have very little to do with the reality. Mm. We're living in an age, it seems to me, of just illusion. And everybody's going along with it and pretending to be clever insider participants. It's nonsense. I also think we're living in a time where people's skin has become so thin. You say anything, ironically, satirically, and it's taken as offense. And one starts screaming. I don't like it. I just think people have become more and more timid about comedy. And to me, the sacred cows are there to be attacked, punctured, because if they truly are worthy of belief, they should be able to resist any amount of satire or comedy. So I think there's no limit to humor as long as it's good humor. So I don't know. It's a funny time.
We'll take it right there. Good thing your skin's not so thin. Of course, Variety came out with this report that you had died. We're so happy that you haven't. You sound very much alive. The big new memoir is Gilliam Ask, a pre-posthumous memoir. I want to personally thank you for the adventures of Baron Munchausen. It's played in my house on New Year's Eve for many a year, and we always have such good fun with that in our company.
Thanks.
Terry Gilliam, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
How about you from the movie Fisher King? Terry Gilliam with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. May not be new.